I'm John Davis. I'm the manager of the International Vegetarian Union. I should start by saying what I mean by the word organised up there, because obviously religions have been organised for thousands of years. IVU's definition of membership is any organisation whose primary purpose is to promote vegetarianism. So Christian Vegetarian Association is a member of IVU. We've got the two others, one in America, and there's a Christian Vegetarian Association in Ghana. There'll be a picture of them right at the end, I'll show you. We've got Jewish Vegetarian Societies, Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, Hare Krishnas, and even a Vegetarian Society in Bangladesh, which is all Muslim now. So everywhere. We've got lots of vegan societies as well as vegetarians. So it covers any organisation which is primarily there to promote vegetarianism. And this is how that type of organisation got started. Those of you that have been around a few years may have read things way back that the Vegetarian Society was all founded by the Bible Christian Church in Salford. Sort of. We'll get to that. You might also have heard that the word vegetarian was derived from the Latin vegetus, which is total nonsense, and I'll show you why. It didn't come from that at all. So can we go one click? But what you've got here, a tale of two cities, in the red corner London and the blue corner Manchester. In political terms, it's not so much left and right as left and further left. London. I use the term loosely, this is southeast England and northwest, the broad area. Dr. William Lamb was a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians. In 1804, when he was about 40, he adopted the vegetable diet. And the most common term for it at the time was vegetable diet. You rarely get the word Pythagorean coming in, and it will come in later. He was a highly respected physician. And he continued to be. His colleagues didn't really think much of his diet at the time. But he continued to be very much a part of the establishment. Meanwhile, over in Manchester, the Reverend William Cowherd founded the Bible Christian Church in Salford in 1809. Now, Sam's the real expert on all of this, so if I get anything wrong, she'll correct me. Cowherd was previously a Swedenborgian minister, which was, I think, sort of partly vegetarian. The Bible Christian Church, from the outset, required the congregation to abstain from flesh. And that, as far as I know, was the first Christian church ever to do that, in quite that way. I might be wrong, but I think it was the first. So, if we can go on one more. Go back one. It's playing up.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. No, we're missing something. It's not. Can I? It's just not going. You weren't fine a minute ago.
Yeah.
Right. This is from William Lamb's book of 1815. That's not coming out quite the way it's supposed to, because some of that's supposed to be in bold. I get this everywhere. It never works on computer systems the way you think it will. But what he wrote there: my reason for objecting to every species of matter to be used as food except the direct produce of the earth is founded, as may be seen in my last publication, on the broad ground that no other matter is suited to the organs of man as indicated by his structure. This applies then with the same force to eggs, milk, cheese and fish as to flesh meat. And that is a very unambiguous statement. Mm. You don't get more vegan than that. Mm-hmm. And that was in 1815, and he's referring to his earlier books, which he wrote certainly from 1806. I use that because I don't have a complete scan of the earlier ones, but I do of this. So he's very clear that his idea of the vegetable diet is vegetables. And at that time, they used the word vegetable rather more broadly than we do, in the sense of animal, vegetable, mineral. If he's not animal and mineral, then he's vegetable. So what we now call plant food. And I put a note there at the bottom that in a biography, after he died, his daughter was interviewed. And she said that the family did try to put this into practice. They found it difficult because they liked their cakes and pastries, and they couldn't work out how to make them without using eggs and butter. So they sort of kept it to a minimum, and they made the cakes and pastries with as little egg and butter as possible, pretended they hadn't, because he didn't know anything about cooking. And he pretended he didn't know they had. So they sort of got around. But, you know, it was extremely difficult, but they were seriously trying to follow his ideas on diet. The other thing that went with vegetables was distilled water. The only thing he would drink was distilled water. His particular expertise, the claim to fame, was that he put the spa into Leamington Spa. He was the one who discovered the water, the mineral waters there. And he went on to do quite a lot of other things, even after his strange diet. His colleagues still worked with him, and he was still part of the medical establishment. I know nothing about his religious views, but I will guess he was a fairly non-practicing Anglican, something of that sort. He certainly wasn't anything revolutionary. Now, if we can go on one more, if it will... Right, good. This is the Bible Christian Church. The two pictures at the top, on the left is William Cowherd, the other one Joseph Brotherton. The more alert amongst you might have noticed the two people I'm listing as the founders of the movement to stop eating farm animals were called Lamb and Cowherd.
Yeah.
I'm not making it up. It gets worse in a minute. But down the bottom of that, they've got abstain from the flesh of animals, and this is the basic principle of the Bible Christian Church, and they included fish and fowl. And Cowherd was very specific in his book, which we'll get to in a minute, that he included fish as flesh, and that was out. But flesh of animals does not exclude eggs, dairy, honey, and they promoted that very actively. So there's a significant difference between what we've got in London and Manchester. So if we can go on one more. They all disappear, one more. Now we get John Frank Newton, not to be confused with Isaac Newton, who it seems some people do. John Frank Newton was a patient of William Bland, and in about 1807, he also adopted the vegetable diet, and it was Lamb's version of the vegetable diet, and took his whole family with him and wrote a book. So if we go on one more, click that. This is Newton's book, which he published in 1811, called Return to Nature, with a rather long subtitle, Defense of the Vegetable Regimen, and a bit about his family. And I put a note there that this is similar to Lamb's book, but he goes beyond health. He talks about ethics and a few other things. When he starts talking about animals, and he's clearly concerned about the ethical issue with animals, he's against using animals for entertainment or sport. And he accepts the inevitability, as he sees it, of using animals for labour, using horses for transport and for ploughing, because he just can't see any other way to do it. There were no trains, let alone cars, in those days. So he sort of, yeah, okay, but we've got to look after them in return for the service they're giving us. And in 1811, this is some way ahead of his time. The other thing he put, his idea of return to nature was naturism. And the whole family routinely wandered completely naked around their house in London. You can imagine what the Reverend Cowherd would have made of that. But a little note at the bottom there. Newton was married to Cornelia Collins. Her sister was Harriet de Boinville, I think it's pronounced, who was a widow living in Bracknell. Bracknell was just a little country village in those days, and she had a nice house with lots of grounds. Sometime later, Lamb's daughter married Newton's nephew, who was Harriet's son. So I just put all that, it didn't really matter who married who, but he's just making the point that these are not random individuals. This is a community. And there were others that we don't know the names of because they didn't write books. We only know the famous ones. So there was quite a bit going on, and they hovered between the Newton's house in London and the country house in Bracknell, and started building up this community. So if we can go on one more. Meanwhile, up in Salford, William Cowherd wrote the book Facts Authentic in Science and Religion, designed to illustrate a new translation of the Bible. Now, I don't know whether he translated it or someone else did. The book was published 2 years after he died, and he cited both Lamb and Newton, but he was very careful not to quote the bit from Lamb about not eating eggs and dairy. He left that out. And when he quoted Newton, he used the subtitle, The Defence of the Vegetable Regimen. He did not refer to it as Return to Nature, because I think he knew what that meant. So he was aware of them. I don't know if they were aware of him. Probably not at that point. And the other thing there, Cowherd's book, more than 100 positive references to eggs, dairy and honey. For example, The Promised Land flowing with milk and honey, Exodus 3:8. And for him, flowing with eggs as well. All of these references were saying, this is the food you're meant to eat, but not fish. Now, his point about fish, he argued that the King James Version is mistranslated, and it's not fish at all, it's something else. I'm not getting into that, I'll leave it to the theologians. that was his view, and that's how he came to all this. So we are getting increasingly different things going on in these two sides. So if we can go on one more. Okay, and one more. Right, now this, you probably all heard of him. Percy Bysshe Shelley. In 1812, he was 20 years old. Now if we go on one more. These are some bits about him. This is the reason we know so much about the Bracknell lot, especially, because Shelley was there. Well, everybody writes about Shelley. In 1811, Shelley was 19, he went to Oxford, and at the end of the first term probably got thrown out again. He published a leaflet for one titled The Necessity of Atheism. And I only learned recently, I'm sure some of you know, it was actually a legal requirement at Oxford and Cambridge that students had to be practising Anglicans until some point in the mid-19th century.
But clergy had to be ordained Anglicans. Yeah.
So he got thrown out, along with his friend Thomas Jefferson Hogg, who we'll come back to in a minute. The two of them just chucked out. So he went off, married a 16-year-old girl, and the beginning of 1812, he was in Dublin, in Ireland, and he wrote two letters to a couple of friends saying that he and his wife had adopted the Pythagorean system. It's quite interesting that he uses that term. It's fairly rare. The vast majority of people were calling it the vegetable diet. But Shelley was a classics scholar. He was fluent in Latin and Greek from childhood and had probably read the originals of Ovid and Porphyry and all these people way back. So he called it that. But he was also, we know for certain, reading books by William Godwin. The next one there. Godwin was a radical revolutionary socialist philosopher who was promoting the French Revolution in London. So you can imagine how popular that made him. Godwin had been married to Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote a book on the rights of women in 1791, which didn't go down very well either. This is very much the fringe of society. Godwin had been in and out of the vegetable diet. And Shelley was writing to him while he was in Dublin. Later in 1812, Shelley's back in London. He met Godwin. He also met Godwin's 15-year-old daughter, Mary, who, before very long, became the second Mrs. Shelley and wrote Frankenstein. He liked them young. November the 5th, and we know it's the 5th because it was bonfire night, Godwin's son took Shelley down the road to go and meet John Frank Newton. And he became very much a part of this whole scene in Newton's house in London and the community down in Bracknell. And in the winter of 1812-13, Shelley left his wife in London and went off down to live in this commune. It was a hippie commune, really, in Bracknell. Almost certainly had an affair with the daughter of the house while he was there. And that, as I say, partly why we know so much about it. There's an awful lot written about him there. And in 1813, he published his first major poem, Queen Anne. And the preface to that was Vindication of Natural Diet. Now, that was pretty much a summary of Lamb and Newton's works. There was nothing new in it, nothing original. But he did a very nice summary of it. And I'll put a bit at the bottom, which is actually from Queen Anne. I'm sure some of you know that quote. No longer now he slays the lamb that looks him in the face and horribly devours his mangled flesh. And again, I put it in just to show that this is not just about diet, this is ethics.
Yeah.
He's concerned about animals just as much. Mm-hmm. Right, so we can go on one more. Okay, stop there. What we get now is what I call prototype vegans, which I think is fairly obvious by now from what you've seen. Although prototype hippies might be more appropriate from what they're up to. One more. Right, now this is by Thomas Jefferson Hogg, who was the one who got thrown out of Oxford with Shelley. In the 1850s, he's writing his recollections. And this is his description of what they were eating in Newton's house in London and in Bracknell. Flesh never appeared, nor eggs, nor butter. The two latter used in cookery was sparingly as possible under protest, not approved of, and soon to be dispensed with. Cheese was under the ban, milk and cream not unreservedly. However, they were allowed in pudding, sparingly in tea, as an indulgence to the weakness of the neophytes. And also, note at the bottom, Newton, in his book in 1811, gave a description of his family meals, which is almost identical. So we've got corroboration from two different sources that this really is what they do. They wanted to be vegan, but he just couldn't work out how to do it. When you think margarine wasn't invented until 1870, they certainly didn't have soya milk. It was a struggle. Cakes and pastries were really out. They had no way of making those. But they were trying to do it. So we go on one more now. Now we're back up in Salford. William Cowherd died, and in 1816 Joseph Brotherton took over as pastor. So one more. And this is a note by Derek Antrobus, who's done quite a lot of research on the Salford area and what was going on with the church there. Brotherton succeeded Cowherd as pastor in 1816. The church had been left in a parlous financial state. One of Brotherton's strategies was to increase the value of the site in King Street by new buildings. He erected a lending library and a reading room there. I just put that in to show this is someone who means business. This is not a hippie like the other lot. You know, he's going places and he's getting it organised. And he'll come back quite a lot as we go on. So one more. And one more. Right, now. 1817, this is James Pierpont Greaves, and I guess that most of you have never heard of him. In 1817, no one else had heard of him either. He was fairly insignificant. He was in London. We know a bit about him, but not an awful lot at that time. And he said later that in 1817, he had some sort of mystical revelation which told him to adopt the vegetable diet. Maybe. One thing we do know about him is that at the time he was living next door to the publisher who was putting out all the books by Lamb, Newton and Shelley. So it seemed fairly likely he'd read them. Maybe he was eating too much cheese late at night and reading his books and had his mystical revelation. But he became sort of leaning increasingly towards mystical spiritualism, the occult and all that sort of thing. Certainly not conventional Christianity, as I understand it anyway. And then he disappeared for the next 20, 30 years. He went to Switzerland to study with Pestalozzi, who was the educator. And he eventually came back and wanted to open a school in London. And we'll come back to that later. So if we can go on one more. Same year, 1817, William Metcalf. This is where the names get really silly. Cowherd's deputy is a calf. William Metcalf took 41 members of the Salford congregation and went to Philadelphia and opened another branch of the Bible Christian Church, which flourished very well. It lasted till about 1920, I think. Both of them did, not through their centenaries. So he gets two flags because he went from from England to America. If we go on one more. One of his major achievements was to recruit Sylvester Graham and Dr. William Alcock in 1830. And they both adopted the vegetable diet. They did not become actively involved with the Bible Christian Church, but they were very closely linked to it and worked closely with Metcalfe. So we, one more. That's them. Sylvester Graham, if you've ever heard of Graham crackers in America, that's where that came from. He was promoting brown bread and health food. He was a Presbyterian minister, and in 1826 Alcock became MD, I'll put MD in brackets, he did 1 year's medical training. He called himself a doctor anyway. Those days they didn't worry too much. They both wrote lots of books in the 1830s, especially Alcock, where it doesn't talk about all sorts of things. The important ones, 1838, Alcock's Vegetable Diet, and 1839, Graham's Science of Human Life. Now, they were increasingly referring to their diet as the milk and vegetable diet, which at least is more accurate than simply calling it the vegetable diet when they're using eggs and dairy. So they were very much on that side, very closely involved with the Bible Christian Church in Philadelphia. So we go on one more. This is Amos Bronson Alcott, who was William's second cousin. They grew up together with children and close friends, but they were very different. These three at the bottom were all in New England, in the Boston area. Bronson, as he was known, was involved with the Transcendentalists, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, who wrote on Walden Pond. Thoreau was in and out of the vegetable diet as well. He was part of all that, and again, more of a spiritual side of things. In 1835, he adopted the vegetable diet. There's been much debate as to where that came from. I agree with a biography written way back in 1937 that he did not get this from William. He got it from the Transcendentalists that he was working with, and they were discussing it and experimenting themselves. He went a very different way to William. He became, almost from the start, an out-and-out ethical, animal rights, vegan, and very much on this side of things. So we go on one more. Before he got to the vegetable diet, he opened a school in Boston, and Bronson had been studying Pestalozzi. That name will come back again. And he opened a school, the Temple School in Boston. It only ran for about a year, and he got into awful trouble. For one thing, he had a black child in the class. Well, this is Boston, all anti-slavery, but actually having a black child in the class, that's going too far. He then wrote a book on conversation with children about the Gospels. That got his school shut down. The churches really did not like that, the way he was having these conversations. So he lasted less than a year and he was gone, and the school was gone before he adopted the vegetable diet, which is quite critical. But in the meantime, a woman called Harriet Martineau, who was an English sociologist at this time, happened to be in America, happened to go to Boston, went to Alcott's school while it was still open, picked up his book and another one that was written about school, took them back to London, and gave it to her uncle, who was a friend of James Pierpont Greaves. So Greaves has now got these two books about Bronson Alcott. They're entirely about education. There's absolutely no mention of the diet in them. Purely education. But also the spiritual side of these conversations about the gospel. Greaves immediately recognised a fellow spirit, someone who'd also been studying Pestalozzi. And Greaves was on the verge of opening his own school in London, which would be very similar. So he wrote a letter to Alcott, not knowing that by the time he wrote it, the school had closed, and that Alcott had now adopted the vegetable diet. Greaves had no way of knowing any of that. He got no reply. Alcott did not reply at all, because the school had closed and there was nothing really to talk about, so he just left it. And we'll come back to that in a minute. But go on, one more. And one more. Right, now we're back with Joseph Brotherton. This is the businessman. He's now the MP for Salford, the first MP for Salford. So he's working his way up. And he's still the pastor of the Bible Christian Church in Salford, I think. Unless he handed over to someone else, didn't he, Sam? was he still the pastor when he was MP?
Not during
most of his time. No, he'd handed over, he moved on.
There were a number of
other ministers. Yeah. Okay, so if we can go on one more. Now, on the left, 1838, James Pierpont Greaves opened his school in London, but on Hand Common between Richmond and Kingston. Because he liked these books about Bronson Alcott so much, he called it Alcott House. He never had a reply to his letter, certainly never met him. All he knew is these two books, these were great. So, talk about that. One more. And that was Alcott House. Hand Common, north side of, near the Thames. You can see the house, the garden there, full of fruit and vegetables. They were largely self-sufficient. The note down the bottom, I've quoted from a third party of 1843, who says, neither milk, butter, cheese, eggs, nor any species of flesh, meat, nor animal food, neither tea, coffee, nor any of these artificial stimulants do the Concordis partake of, or supply to others. I quoted a third party because they wrote a book, a little booklet about life in school. And they went through day to day and they described everything they ate. They did not describe what they did not eat. They only listed what they did eat, and it was vegetables, fruit and water. Nothing else. William Lamb, right back up the top there, was still around in London. Shelley had gone to Italy, the Newtons had gone to Cornwall, but Lamb was still there, and he was a visitor at Alcott House. And they finally put into practice his vision of fruit, vegetables and water. Nothing else. And they did it for 10 years. They just didn't eat pies and pastries because they couldn't, and cakes, they couldn't make them, so they didn't have any. They were largely self-sufficient. So this is a totally vegan school. They also said in their booklet that they objected to any use of animals for entertainment, for sport and for work. They were now objecting to animals because they had trains by them. You could go from London to Manchester on the train. So they were ruling out any use of animals for any purpose whatsoever, and any type of animal food whatsoever. One more. 1841, they reorganised and called it the Concordium, the New Industrial Harmonious College, or something. But it was still in Alcott House. They just changed the name, which is why it refers down there in 1843 to the Concordis. The name was because Bronson Alcott's hometown was Concord, Massachusetts. And they quite liked that. One more. 1842, the word vegetarian, the first ever printed record of the word, appeared in the Alcott House journal, The Healthium. We do have a possible handwritten one earlier from somebody else connected with them, but that's the first printed one that we know about. And what we've done in the last few months during the course of this year, with some help from some friends at Harvard and Berkeley universities, we've gone through over 10 million online books, which have all been scanned, you know, Google Books have put them all on there. And we have found every printed use of the word vegetarian from 1842 to 1847. Every single one of them. And we also looked at all the uses of the phrase vegetable diet. Vegetable diet comes up about 2,000 times during those 5 years. It was still the most common phrase. The word vegetarian appears in 8 journals in those 5 years, only 8. And every single one of them was people very closely connected with Alcott House. That is where the word vegetarian came from. There's absolutely no question of it. They started it, and when you look at that green panel, the bottom of the middle, that is what they meant by it. There's no question of that either. Vegetarian was vegan, ethical vegan, totally. So we can go on one more. Lots of flags. This will get a bit confused. In 1842, Bronson Alcott, having now got in touch, the school wrote to him and said, look, we've opened this school and called it Alcott House. So he replied. He went over, spent 4 months at Alcott House. And at the end of the 4 months, he took two of the people, leading members of Alcott House, back to Boston with him. And they set up a commune near Harvard called Fruitlands. This, again, was a totally ethical vegan commune. They had their families there with them. They came unstuck. It lasted about 6 months. They refused to use animals for ploughing. And the commune was basically a lot of women and children who ended up doing most of the work, while a bunch of old men were sitting around talking about philosophy. So their ploughing the field didn't get anywhere because they wouldn't use animals. The whole thing just collapsed. But it was a nice idea. The reason we know so much about this one is because Bronson Kenmure's daughter was living there, and her name was Louisa May Olcott, who later wrote Little Women. But later on, she went back to meat eating, and she didn't really think much of all this when she was 10. Various biographers have twisted that even further and accused Bronson of child abuse because he wouldn't let his daughter eat meat and all this. You know, horrendous. But again, you know, a lot of these things we only know about because somebody famous was there, like Shelley in the other one and Louisa May in this one. So we get lots of information about what they were doing. So we go on one more. Right, now all that's gone. What has been added now, right at the bottom left, 1847 Vegetarian Society. Now what happened here, just to backtrack slightly, in 1841, the first hydropathic institute was opened in Britain. Hydropathic is the water cure system. It started in Germany, and a German called Presner came over to England and opened a hydropathic institute that we learned over there, and he opened it in Olcott House. Meanwhile, just up the road in Hayes, Middlesex, which is not far, a man called William Horsell was studying all this as well. He obviously spent some time at Olcott House. In 1845, he wrote a book called Hydropathy, or Hydropathy, however you pronounce it, for the people. A couple of years later, winter 1846-47, he opened his own institute, but effectively moved the one from Olcott House down to Ramsgate in Kent, Northwood Villa, and opened his own down there. He had also taken over publishing the Olcott House Journal, which was originally called The Healthy and then became The New Age, subtitled Temperance Advocate. Horsell published a journal called The Truth Tester, subtitled The Healthy and the Temperance Advocate. He took it over and carried it on from Ramsgate. And in early 1847, one of his readers from Hampshire wrote to this journal and said, wouldn't it be a good idea if we had a vegetarian society? And as far as we know, that's the first time this had ever been suggested. First time anyone thought of it. It was followed up by William Oldham, who was the business manager at Olcott House. And he called the meeting July 1847 at Olcott House. Anyone interested, come along. And they got quite a lot of people there. One more click. One of the people who turned up at that meeting was James Simpson. He was a very prominent member of the Bible Christian Church in Salford. And from, I think, 1838, they trained from Manchester to London so they could get up and down there. And, of course, Joseph Brotherton, as MP, was spending most of his time in London. So we're finally getting some connections between these two. Simpson was also a very wealthy industrialist. He had money, lots of money. So you can see why the other lot on the left liked the idea of him coming to their meeting. Olcott House was struggling by this time, financially, it was in trouble. They had a meeting in July, and Simpson was there, and he got up and spoke, and apparently the first time he ever spoke in public was at this meeting. And there was an account of the food laid on their tea on the lawns at Olcott House. And, of course, being Olcott, it was vegetables and water. But they did say they made some cakes and pastry with the minimum possible eggs and butter they put in. And the phrase they used was that they thought it might help the carnivores in transition. What they really meant was that it would help James Simpson with his money. They were not daft. But he was very keen. So it's an awkward match, because you see everything's going on. They're very different lifestyles, very different diet, a whole way of thinking. And I put a little note under there about abstaining from flesh and not abstaining from eggs and dairy and this. And they had to try to bring it together. So we can go on one more. That's Joseph Brotherton again. In That meeting in July, they adjourned it to September, 30th of September 1847, and they had the second meeting at Northwood Villa in Ramsgate in Kent, which was the hydropathic hospital. And Joseph Brotherton was there, and because he was an MP and he's the most senior person, they invited him to chair the meeting. Now somehow that's gone down in mythology that he founded the Vegetarian Society. No, he chaired the meeting that set it up. They very sensibly elected James Simpson as president, and they elected William Oldham, the business manager of Walcot House, as treasurer, and William Horsell, who was in Ramsgate and publishing the journal, as the secretary. Can we go on one more? Right, bottom left, 1848, Walcot House closed. Finally run out of steam, 10 years. Typical, really, of the, you know, radical revolutionaries, great new ideas, and they're just burning out. Anyway. But they had quite an impact during those 10 years. And at this point, Simpson's back in Salford. Horsell and Oldham are now in London. The hydropathic hospital in Ramsgate closed down, I think, 1849, didn't last long. But Horsell was still the secretary and running the Vegetarian Society from London, and now retitled his journal as the Vegetarian Advocate, which, as far as he was concerned, was the official magazine of the Vegetarian Society. By 1849, Simpson up in Salford was publishing the Vegetarian Messenger, which stated that that was the official journal of the Vegetarian Society. This little odd alliance really wasn't working very well. Inevitably, Simpson won. He'd got the money. He could do it. The London end folded. Simpson moved the whole thing, lock, stock and barrel, up to Salford. And as you all know, the Vegetarian Society has been in Manchester ever since. The crucial thing along the way at that meeting in Ramsgate, the definition of the Vegetarian Society, the objective was to promote abstaining from the flesh of animals. Nothing else. They did not redefine the word vegetarian, but when you take the title of the society and that objective, you've got a different meaning to the word. If we can go on one more. In 1850, a serious medical journal in London printed a 22-page review of all this. They got hold of the first ever vegetarian cookbook produced by the Vegetarian Society in 1848, which had an astonishing amount of eggs and dairy in it. I've seen the extract, not the whole bit, but it is a lot. They went through it and they analysed the typical diet of a meat-eating family and the diet of somebody following this new cookbook, and they said there's no difference. All they've done is substitute one form of animal food for another. And they said, not true vegetarianism. Because this is London, medical people. They'd had 40 years of William Lamb up the top telling them what the vegetable diet was, and they'd had 10 years ear-bashing from Olcott House. And then suddenly they get this cookbook, which is full of eggs and dairy. No wonder they're confused. So we go on one more. 1850 to 60, the American Vegetarian Society, now that was founded, we're going back to Philadelphia now. The three immediately above it, Metcalf, Graham and Alcott, New York, 1850, founded the American Vegetarian Society. It lasted until 1860. The reason it ended was because within a year or two they were struggling financially. I mean, America's a big place. Trying to run this, you know. James Simpson in Salford bailed them out and put in the money to keep the American Society going. Simpson died in 1859. That was the end of the American Society. It was very nearly the end of the British Society. Through the 1860s they struggled. 1870s, they got new people came in, particularly Francis Newman, the brother of Cardinal Newman, who I think was mentioned somewhere yesterday. Francis Newman became president of the Vegetarian Society with very different ideas. I mean, he was not part of this Bible Christian Church tradition, but there were other people from the church still there, still very much involved. And they had these discussions in the 1870s because they knew the word vegetarian was all wrong for what they were doing. They were very well aware of it. They consider changing the name to the Food Reform Society, and there were several of those around. VEM is Vegetable Egg and Milk Diet, which would commonly be in use, and they could actually consider changing the name to the Vegetable Egg and Milk Society, which was kind of a mouthful. But they knew it just wasn't right, and they were trying to work out how to get around it. And then we got an article by Newman, 1875, where he said that vegetarians must be ever aiming to reduce milk products. This is a complete reversal of William Cowherd's position from 1816. And so he's now saying, well, you know, we use it because we don't know what else to use, but we should stop. Then in 1886, you've got Henry Clubb down there. Now, Henry Clubb was briefly at Alcott House, became James Simpson's secretary in Salford, went over to America, wandered around all over the place, then went to Philadelphia, became the pastor of the Bible Christian Church in Philadelphia. 1886, he restarted what he now called the Vegetarian Society of America, and totally in the same tradition as all the others above on that side. That lasted, the Philadelphia Church and that society lasted until about 1820 when Clubb died, and they both died with him, and that was the end of that. We go on one more. On the left, Anna Kingsford. She gets a French flag. Some of you might have heard of her. Now this was in 1886, 2 years after she died, this was published posthumously from the introduction to her last book. For the past 15 years, I have been an abstainer from flesh meats, not a vegetarian, because during the whole of that period, I have used such animal produce as butter, cheese, eggs, and milk. And reading that today, I think most of us find it odd. But she was perfectly clear what the word vegetarian meant. Anna Kingsford, in case you don't know about her, she wanted to be a doctor. Women didn't do things like that in Britain in the 1880s, so she went to Paris, trained as a doctor in Paris, had to do it all in French, of course, wrote her dissertation on the perfect way in diet, qualified, came back to London and said, I'm a doctor now, and carried on. And they couldn't stop her. And good for her. But she was also, the reason she's on the left, she was a theosophist, very much into the spiritualism again, the occult and all that sort of thing. One more. 1944, the Vegan Society was saying, I put deja vu, because if you look straight underneath it, 1842, the word vegetarian, it meant exactly the same thing. And it's, to me, it's a shame, because, you know, in 1944, they had to come up with the word vegan, because vegetarian had just been so distorted and become meaningless. But it's a shame, because simply by inventing the word vegan, they actually pushed the word vegetarian even further towards being overlapped. So now we've got, as far as I'm concerned, two words which mean exactly the same thing. I'm quite happy with people calling themselves lacto-vegetarian or ovo-lacto-vegetarian, but then what's a vegetarian? It sort of came home to me last year. I flew to Asia with Emirates Airlines. When you go to the Emirates website, it gives you all the list of food options, different meals, and the three relevant ones: one, ovo-lacto vegetarian; two, lacto-vegetarian; three, vegetarian. Well, if it's not ovo and it's not lacto, what is it? So I ordered that one, and it came with a sticker on it saying vegan. And we're seeing more and more of this. I was in California in February. And it's become almost synonymous. Vegetarian and vegan are virtually the same thing, they know. And it's happening more and more. And I think it is going to happen further. And personally, I'm quite happy to push it a bit further. Yeah. It clarifies it to me. Part of the reason for that, and why this happened in 1944, the whole of the 19th century, vegetarian movement was expanding. Right up really to the First World War, there was a huge amount going on. The First World War really finished it, and the whole period between the wars, there was still the Vegetarian Society there, it's still going on, but it was struggling. And a movement in that kind of struggle really can't be bothered arguing about the meanings of words. You're more concerned with just keeping going at all. So it just drifted, and vegetarian became totally overlapped over that period, which is why you got that reaction in 1944. It was inevitable. Last one. IVU in the 21st century. All of these pictures are in the last few years. Oh, the top right, that's me in China last year. I get around a bit. The others are in Indonesia, Brazil. This one down here, can I get a pointer to it? That one is in Ghana, which was jointly organised by the Christian Vegetarian Association of Ghana. So I think that's probably some of their members over there. Above that is India, to the right is Dubai. And the interesting thing, if you look top left, you can just see the word vegetarian in the background in Indonesia. Bottom left, you can see vegetarian in China. You think, well, they would have made a Lissabon car house with the word they'd invented going around there. Now, these are all international gatherings which IVU has supported, where world congresses, regional congresses, sub-regional, anything as long as these people from different countries getting together. We support these all over the world, and for the last 11 years, since 1999, and therefore the whole of the 21st century, all of the food at every international gathering has been completely vegan. All of it. And we still call them vegetarian congresses. Well, we're just pushing it back. Quite deliberately. So that's where it all ended up. Now, when you think the people back in Alcott House in 1840 looking at that, they would have been surprised at what they started.
But pleased. But pleased.
Yeah. So there you are. Well, that is it. Any questions?
Thank you.
It was Donald Watson, the founder of the Vegan Society, that said that the word vegan is the beginning and the end of vegetarianism, as in the first two letters and the last two letters.
Yeah. In 1944, in 1842, it meant exactly the same thing, but it had become totally distorted and meaningless. And, I've done the whole story of the Vegan Society. They were all members of the Vegetarian Society, and they wanted to form a non-dairy section within the Vegetarian Society. And the Society said, no, that would be too divisive, we can't have that. So it got even more divisive, they just left and started another one and invented a new word, which was a great shame that they were pushed into doing that. Sorry, you?
Do you not think that given that it's going to be a question of degrees anyway, going from eating meat to being a vegetarian to being a vegan, and you know, some abstinence is going to be better than any, than none, rather. Don't you think the focus on the semantics of vegetarian and vegan is kind of a waste of time, really, when there are other things you could be focusing
ultimately, on? Ultimately, yes. I'd like to see the word vegetarian and vegan disappear altogether. As far as I'm concerned, we are normal. Normal doesn't need a label. It's the flesh eaters that should be labelled. So, ultimately, I'd like to see the end of it completely. I'd like to see the end of these green symbols saying suitable for vegetarians and have red ones saying he's got meat in it. But that's a long way off. In the meantime, I just think it needs some clarity and it's worth putting the record straight. For me, as someone, I'm not a professional historian, but it's something I do a lot with. And I like to get historical facts straight, and if that's the way it was, then I think people should know the way it was and not have other stories made up about it.
Would there be any benefit in sort of pushing the idea of signing the pledge? Because that the media could focus in on that. People are signing a pledge for fruit, veg and water or something like this.
There are quite a lot of groups and societies that do that. The International Meatless Day run from Malaysia do that. They go around getting people to sign pledges. Paul McCartney's been doing it with his Meat Free Mondays. Yeah, there's a lot of it goes on. How effective it is, I don't know. For me, within IVU, I don't get involved in specific campaigns. IVU doesn't. We are supporting all the member societies. And they've all got very different ideas about what they do and how they do it. And very often not agreeing with each other at all. So, yes, I think it's a valid idea and people do use that. Yeah.
I'm just a bit intrigued. What did they do for protein?
Protein?
Yeah, did they get enough protein? Or are they,
Beans and grains.
Yeah.
Beans and grains, you've got protein. Yeah. But that, I mean, as I said, when they said vegetable, they meant plant food.
Yeah, because it wouldn't have been tofu or
soy. Oh, no, nothing like that. But, yeah, any combination of beans and grains.
Yeah.
But they didn't know that, because they didn't know about vitamins. And none of that had been discovered.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of promoting eggs and dairy didn't know about cholesterol.
Mm.
Or global warming, or factory farming, any of it.
Yeah,
it's all different. The protein's there. The bigger question was B12, where they got that.
Yeah.
But my guess is that the 1840s, the standards of hygiene weren't quite what we have today. Mm. Well, they're growing all their own food in the garden, and there's B12 with a bit of luck in the soil. But there are no reports of the sort of illnesses that we'd expect from that, so they were surviving somehow.
Yeah.
I had understood that part of the reason for the Vegan Society forming in 1944 was a dispute over rationing and the special provision that ended up being made for vegetarians under a particular definition. That they would be allowed extra cheese because they wouldn't be eating meat. Now, if that's true, that suggests to me that by that time there was some kind of sort of vegetarian identity allowed cheese and milk that had enough power to sort of have some political influence.
Can I just clarify what happened there? There were two vegetarian societies. The original Vegetarian Society in Manchester was a London Vegetarian Society, which was split off in 1888. Was running separately. By the Second World War, they're both running as national societies, both saying to the government, we want some special provision. And the government said, we're not going to deal with two of you, go and bang your heads together. And they formed a joint committee, and we've still got all the minutes from that, to negotiate with the government on the special vegetarian ration coupons. And there were 100,000 of them issued, so we've actually got an accurate figure about how many ovo-lacto vegetarians there were during the Second World War. I'm not aware of any ration coupons for vegans. Never heard of it.
Well, quite, that's what I mean.
Yeah, they got cheese, extra cheese instead of the sausages, cheese and eggs. I've never heard of a vegan ration coupon.
No, I haven't either. No. But all I mean is therefore, in the early 1940s, the lacto-ovo-vegetarians had some kind of identity, and government was dealing with that identity.
Yeah. Oh yeah, provided they got together instead of two separate groups, which in the end the government did them a favour because they merged in 1969 into what we've got now. Donald Watson became effectively vegan in 1940. He was vegetarian, ovo-lacto from the 1920s, because he stopped eating eggs, dairy in 1940, and then by 1944, with all the difficulties he led the others and came up with the word vegan. So what they did was rationing went on until 1952, I think. So what they did the rest of the time, I don't know. Must have been difficult for them. Initially, they were all trying to work together. The Vegan Society joined IVU, I think, pretty much from the outset. Certainly the 1947 IVU Congress, Donald Watson was there as a speaker. And they were very much part of it, still all trying to work together. We have the two vegetarian societies and a vegan society now. It was all quite amicable, but different.
Okay, we've got time for one more question. I think this guy at the back's had a while.
It might just be a comment, but perhaps you will comment as well. it's interesting the different positive and negative definitions, isn't it, of diet? And perhaps in a modern context, it's often easiest to say, don't eat meat or don't eat flesh. But in fact, if one is a vegan, then perhaps it's simpler to say that what you do eat is purely vegetable origin. Now, in the early days, it seems generally Dr. Lamb was saying what he advocated was vegetables.
Yeah.
There was nothing negative about that.
Yeah. Whereas the Bible Christian Church was saying abstain from flesh. This is, I had a long chat with David yesterday about this. It's something I've been pushing a bit in discussions on email, some of the email groups, the positive versus negative. My view increasingly strongly is that we should be promoting a positive image and not the negative. I define myself by what I do, not by what I do not do. Because if I define what I do not do, then I'm saying what I don't do is normal, and I'm abnormal.
Well, there's one more question over here first.
I was just wondering if you thought by really sort of pushing for strict definitions of vegetarian and vegan and stuff, you're perhaps increasing conflict between the movement, because vegetarians argue about whether or not fish is okay, vegans can sometimes refer to vegetarians as not quite doing the whole hog yet. And I wondered if perhaps we should doing some sort of united front under compassion.
Sure.
Something like that.
Sure. But I am interested in the historical accuracy of words. And I appreciate entirely what you're saying, except I don't agree that vegetarians argue about fish. Fish is not vegetarian, end of. There's nothing to argue about. I'm perfectly happy with people who eat a plant-based diet plus fish. If that's what's right for them, then I totally respect that. No problem. But it's just for me, there is an issue about the meaning of words, partly because I'm the manager of the International Vegetarian Union, and people say, what does vegetarian mean? And I don't want to be the manager of something rather vague and fuzzy. I want to know what it means. I want it precise.
Yeah.
I do appreciate the concern, is that, however we define ourselves, we all want to work together.
Yeah.
And everybody's in a different path along the way, slightly different position. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. We all want the same thing. Yeah, absolutely.